Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, and the holiday season is a great time to take stock of the things we're grateful for, like family, a good meal, or listening to a well-told story. NHPR has been by your side all year, serving you and your community with thorough, dedicated news, right alongside moments of gratitude that offer perspective. As this year comes to a close, we hope you consider showing your gratitude by making a year-end gift. Give now at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. COVID-19 rates are rising in New Hampshire. Yesterday, 625 new cases were reported and 7 new deaths, bringing the number of deaths in New Hampshire from COVID-19 to 544. When the vaccine comes, who's going to get it? And who is keeping track of a two-dose system? Lawmakers kicked off their work for the new session this week, and they did so outdoors to stay as safe as possible. And also in the news this week, a Granite Stater gets drafted to Team Biden. These stories and more up for discussion on today's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. So glad you're with us today. And we're going to start the show today with a conversation about the state's response to COVID-19. Let us know what you think of the state's response, or if you've got a question about it, ask it now. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And with me now are a few reporters who have been covering the COVID-19 pandemic, Nancy West of indepthnh.org and NHPR's Jordan Haim. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Nancy, we'll start with you first. Yesterday, we learned that there were 7 new outbreaks in institutions, long-term care facilities, and a correctional facility. You've been watching the course of the pandemic over the year. What stood out to you about these new outbreaks and about how things are different now than they were during the first surge in the spring?
Well, I think what's been really evident to me is the number of cases that have occurred in this second surge. When the first outbreak started to be reported, there were a handful of cases. In most cases, there weren't large numbers. And today we're seeing much higher numbers in the outbreaks and much more serious repercussions, a lot of deaths. There were, I think, 7 deaths yesterday related to long-term care facilities. And the day before, 9 deaths, 7 of them were related to long-term care facilities. So I think we're in for, you know, a very challenging time keeping nursing home residents safe here.
Also yesterday, Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist, announced a change to quarantine requirements based on updated guidelines for the CDC. He said the state will adopt the new quarantine policy of 10 days if you've been exposed but have no symptoms. But he also said the state would not be adopting a second guideline from the CDC, which says that people who have tested negative only need to quarantine for 7 days. So here is Dr. Chan at that press conference yesterday.
The testing resources and the testing supplies need to be targeted to those most at need, those people who might be developing symptoms of COVID-19 and need testing. So logistically, the capacity to test everybody exposed to COVID-19 is limited.
So that's state epidemiologist Ben Chan. Jordan Haim, what do you make of this? Does this reflect what you've been hearing about testing capacity?
Yeah, I mean, that does kind of line up with what I've been seeing, especially within the past week in New Hampshire. I mean, up until now, the state and testing sites have seemed pretty confident that anybody who wants to get tested for COVID-19 can get a test. But of course, in especially the past 2 weeks with the holiday, lots of people were running out to get tested, you know, before they went to a Thanksgiving gathering, or after they went to a gathering, they, you know, want to get tested to make sure that they weren't exposed. So, you know, the demand at these testing sites has just been way up this past week. A lot of them have been full every single day. And there's also a lot more just general exposure in the community, as our epidemiologists have been telling us for the past few weeks. There's just so much more community exposure now. So testing sites, you know, they've been seeing a lot longer wait times. People are having a bit of a hard time getting tested. So it does kind of make sense that, you know, people with symptoms, people who are highest at risk, are kind of being prioritized for testing right now.
Yeah, I will say, you know, there are different kinds of tests, right? There's the antigen test, which is if you're having symptoms, they can get you the results within 15 minutes. Full disclosure, I had one of those tests a few Fridays ago, came up negative, thankfully. I was with my girlfriend. She had the PCR test, which is generally more reliable, but takes longer to get back to you the results. She didn't get her results until 11 days later, a letter in the mail. She was also negative. So, yeah, I can certainly attest to the difference in wait times depending on the kind of test. Lots of people are worried about hospitals and their capacity to treat all those who have severe complications of COVID-19. Dr. Chan says that there are no hospitals operating under surge capacity, to his knowledge, in New Hampshire right now. Here are his comments on that yesterday at the press conference.
If and when hospitals hospital capacity does increase, hospitals themselves have internal surge plans to be able to increase, you know, their own capacity even further. And the state has the option of, you know, standing up alternate care sites to help offload the burden on the hospitals. So, you know, this continues to be a very dynamic space with the numbers constantly changing and hospitals and healthcare agencies dealing with staffing shortages, which may limit bed capacity as well. So we'll continue to work with hospitals.
So on the subject of staffing capabilities, Jordan Haim, what have you heard about that?
Well, there are some hospitals that are anticipating some critical staffing shortages in the coming weeks as, you know, we're seeing hospitalizations continue to go up. But so far, I've spoken with a lot of hospitals this week, and they say, like, they are concerned, but staffing is only really a problem for one hospital that I've spoken with so far, and that's Lakes Region General Hospital in Laconia. As of Tuesday, they had 14 staff in quarantine. And less than five were out of work with COVID-19 in isolation. So they said that, you know, since they are such a small hospital system, it is putting a bit of a strain on them. And these, just to clarify, they all were community-based transmission cases. They weren't cases that were coming from within the hospital.
They don't believe that they were caught, they caught the virus in the hospital or were possibly exposed in the hospital, just outside the hospital?
That's correct. Yeah, the cases came from community transmission outside of the hospital. Hospitals are a little bit worried about staffing right now, but I guess for the most part, it seems like only for this one hospital, it's really become a problem. But staffing is definitely a concern.
Okay.
You know, I wanted to add to what Jordan said for hospital staffing. When it comes to staffing at nursing homes, it's a critical problem. And fortunately, Governor Sununu recently reinstated the extra $30 a week $300 a week,
yep,
for people who worked at Medicaid nursing homes. But staffing there is very, very difficult. I know within the last 2 weeks, the Coos County Nursing Hospital up in West Stewartstown was in dire condition. I mean, there was no one there to answer the phone. Everybody was on the floor trying to take care of, you know, all of the patients. And I think this is possibly going to be something that we see more in the rural areas where there are fewer people to, you know, pull from, to pick from, to help out. This nursing and staffing shortage is at crisis proportions in the nursing homes. And I think before we get too far into this next surge, it's going to be a major problem at the hospitals as well, because it's only it only makes common sense that some of the staff is going to come down with or test positive with COVID-19 and have to quarantine.
And Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I have heard anecdotally that some of the folks who work at one nursing home may also have a part-time job at another nursing home, which increases the chance that, any given nursing home employee might get caught with COVID. And that COVID could spread from one nursing home directly to another via an employee. Is that true?
You know, I have heard that as well, but I think it's far less likely with this new with the stipend brought on again, the $300 a week, because it when people are making $12 an hour, sometimes it's necessary to moonlight at other places. But with this stipend, we're hoping that will decrease. And I don't think that's the critical problem. Right now, you have so much community transmission that it's almost impossible to think that people can avoid having some sort of contact with it. That's why all Governor Sununu and all of the experts at yesterday's press conference really stressed, okay, we have a vaccine coming, but we really have to make sure we double down on our efforts to wear masks, to do social distancing, to really wash our hands, to make sure we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. Even though the vaccine is, they're talking about the most vulnerable citizens getting the vaccine by Christmas, but that's the first dose. Both of the new vaccines that are coming to New Hampshire, both have second doses that are going to be required. One is 21 days, the other is 28 days after the first dose. So it's going to be, even for the most vulnerable, into January before they complete the what they need to do to take the, you know, the two-pronged shots.
Listeners, we're speaking about the state's response to COVID-19, and we're also going to be talking in just a little bit more about the vaccine distribution process, who's going to get it first. We'll hear from what the governor had to say about that at his press conference yesterday. But if you have questions about this particular aspect or any other thing related to the state's response to COVID-19, give us a call now. We'd like to get your question on the air. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Nancy West, while we're on the subject of nursing homes, I wanted to ask you if you what you could tell us about the state of the New Hampshire Veterans Home. We heard in the past few days that since November 10th, I believe it is, 21 veterans have died from COVID-19, and more than 100 staff and residents have been infected with the virus. What can you tell us about the state of affairs at the New Hampshire Veterans Home?
Well, you know, it's like any of these nursing homes. Once COVID-19 gets in, it spreads like wildfire. It's very, very difficult to tamp down. And now with community transmission everywhere, that doesn't bode well for nursing homes anywhere in the state. Now, we did a deep dive last month at a time when there were only four outbreaks at nursing homes in the state. And we found that it was the nursing homes that were closest to areas where there was a lot of community transmission that had the highest likelihood of bringing in COVID-19. That's why testing at nursing homes, PPE, having adequate staff are all so important. And testing especially, it's very difficult to have staff coming and going into nursing homes and only being tested occasionally. So I suspect they'll be ramping up testing in the nursing homes in the coming weeks and prioritizing that because it's crucial to keep people safe.
Before we leave the subject of hospitals, I wanted to ask you, Jordan Haim, with respect to hospitals, how are things different from in the spring when cases were also high, but hospitals were not doing any elective procedures and were taking other measures to ensure they had enough resources? What do you think, Jordan?
Yeah, the surge it's definitely different from the one that we saw in the spring for a few reasons. Hospitals are feeling a lot better about it this time around just because they're more prepared. There was a lot they learned in the spring about how to handle a surge in hospitalizations. And so when it comes to things like elective procedures, you know, that was those were scaled back kind of statewide and nationwide last spring, but we're not seeing that right now. And the hospitals that I've spoken with are really encouraging people to continue coming into hospitals and going to see their doctor if they need to, because they are better equipped to handle hospitalizations right now. They don't want people to be scared to come in. And they say that they can handle, you know, COVID and any non-COVID procedures right now.
Okay.
There is one hospital that I've spoken with so far, the only one that I've spoken with who has kind of begun to change their procedures a little bit is Elliott Hospital in Manchester. Of course, in Manchester, there's been, you know, a lot more cases and hospitalizations than in other parts of the state. So they just decided last week that they would be scaling down some of their elective procedures. They can usually do sometimes more than 20 per day, And now they've decided they're going to scale that back to about 9 per day, just to make sure that they can, you know, handle everything that's going on in the hospitals.
Let's talk a little bit about vaccines. As we mentioned, Pfizer, Moderna, they're applying for emergency approval for their COVID-19 vaccines. They require 2 doses. And New Hampshire healthcare officials are preparing for the distribution of this vaccine. And Governor Chris Sununu was asked yesterday during his press conference about who gets priority access to the vaccine.
When the first Pfizer doses arrive, primarily they will be going to hospitals and the doctors and the nurses that are on the front lines in some of our highest risk settings, to be sure. Then also as part of that, what we call, I think we call it 1A. We have a 1A and 1B, depending on the really on the amount of that we get. There would also be folks in congregate settings, long-term care facilities, the elderly in those settings. First responders are also part of that group as well.
Okay, so that's Governor Sununu speaking at his press conference yesterday. And Jordan Haim, he mentioned 1A and 1B. Can you tell us a little bit about what those are, 1A, 1B?
Yeah, so phase 1A is kind of the first part of the first phase of vaccinations that we're going to see once the first vaccines are approved and start coming to New Hampshire. So 1A, as we just heard the governor mention, is going to be what is considered the most high-risk people. So that's like high-risk healthcare workers, people in long-term care facilities, and first responders. So, you know, of course, those are people who are working with, you know, potentially sick people and working with patients every day. They want to make sure that they're getting vaccinated first. We have, I believe it was mentioned at the press conference yesterday, 100,000 total people in that 1A stage. So it is going to take a while to get all of those people vaccinated first. We're not going to get 100,000 doses of the vaccine in the next few weeks. It's going to take some time.
And they didn't specify exactly how much time. I'm sure there are people out there who know they won't fall within the 1A group who still want that vaccine and are itching to take it.
That's correct. Yeah. They don't know how long that could take, but the governor estimated yesterday that in December, we could get anywhere from 10 to 40,000 doses of the vaccine in December.
And if it's 40,000 doses, that's 20,000 people. So
that's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, and I think there is hope that there will be other drug manufacturers coming on board so that it over time, it won't be just these two manufacturers, which could really increase the number of people who can be vaccinated.
We can only hope, right, that there are so many options for us so that we can stay as safe as possible and stay healthy as the virus still continues to spread.
Paula Tracy asked kind of a good question yesterday. She asked Governor Sununu which group he would be falling into. Would he be, because he's out and about, because he's very busy working on the pandemic, if he would be among the first to receive it? And he said, no, he'd be at the back of the line with everybody else in his age and health group.
Yeah, he talked about being a healthy 46-year-old and that,
yes.
You know, just because
yes.
He's an important person, you know, he's going to fall in line with his demographic rather than his position in the state.
Yes, which I found interesting.
Jordan, you've talked with healthcare officials on the seacoast who are seeking volunteers for vaccine administration. What did you hear from them?
So I spoke with the Seacoast Public Health Network. And this is like only one public health network. There's several in all regions of the state. And they're basically going to be coming into vaccine distribution at phase 1B, which is going to be, you know, other high risk people, older adults living in other types of congregate settings, but not long term care facilities. And that will also be, you know, people with comorbidities who are very high risk. So once that phase begins is when these public health networks are going to begin their vaccine distribution. And they're looking for volunteers right now, volunteer vaccinators. So those are people who are in healthcare fields who can actually administer this vaccine. And they're also looking for people who don't have any experience in healthcare, people who can just kind of watch people in the 15 minutes after they get their vaccine, kind of after you get your flu shot, to make sure that you're all right and you can get up and leave once you're done.
Okay, so volunteers are being sought for that. Also, Governor Sununu talked a little bit about his plan to use the National Guard to help distribute vaccines. Jordan, did he give a timeline for that?
Extension of the National Guard, he requested an extension through March, and that was actually just recently approved. And Sununu did say that National Guard would be really important in helping administer the vaccine to kind of the wider populations in New Hampshire. But that's not going to be in the 1A or the very beginning stages of distribution in the next few weeks. So they're going to become important more down the line.
All right. Well, Nancy West, I wanted to ask you, what else is standing out to you about the pandemic right now as far as cases in New Hampshire go and how our state is dealing with this crisis as we head into the next few weeks?
You know, I think one of the things that I was concerned about was learning that there, there's a dozen cases among the inmates at New Hampshire State Prison for men in Concord. It's just very difficult when COVID-19 gets into a setting, you know, closed setting like that. And in 1 week, it jumped from 6 cases to 12 cases. And it was mainly among people who were in the secure psychiatric unit, but there were also a couple in the main prison section. So I think that's very concerning because it's hard to control when you have a large amount of people in a space where they have been very lucky and very, very committed to keeping COVID out of the state prison. So, and they do have plans in place to make sure that it is limited. But as I said, it's just one of those things. The virus doesn't know rules. It does its own thing. So that's been very concerning. But overall, I think the exciting thing is, you know, we can't overlook how great it is that we're going to be seeing a vaccine coming sooner than I expected, really. And I think that's going to really change the dynamics, especially once the very vulnerable people are vaccinated. I know even today, it's been holding steady at about 81 or 82% of all the deaths in New Hampshire are linked to long-term care facilities. So having those folks vaccinated and your first responders and the medical personnel, I think that's going to be a huge game changer.
And Nancy, just a quick follow-up on your reporting on inmates who may have been infected. Are you reaching out to the Department of Corrections to get more information about what they are doing to protect inmates there? And if so, has the DOC been responsive to you?
Well, the DOC puts all of this information on its website. Now, late May, they had their first case of COVID-19, and they issued a news release. Now, I've noticed now they issue no news releases, but you have to go to their website and see what the numbers say. I usually try to confirm that through Helen Hanks, the Commissioner of Corrections, but beyond what's on their website, they really have not been responsive to specific questions.
And to you, Jordan Haim, what do you think about what's standing out to you at this point in the pandemic? It's getting bad now. It was bad earlier this year. Is there anything that stands out, makes this a little different to you in your eyes?
Well, something that I've just been keeping an eye on in the last few weeks is just what kinds of restrictions and guidelines New Hampshire has been imposing in response to the pandemic. You know, we saw in the spring as well that New Hampshire was slower to shut down things, like especially involving the economy. And we just became the final state in New England to impose a mask mandate just a few weeks ago. So Sununu made pretty clear in the press conference yesterday that there aren't any plans for further restrictions right now. Of course, that could change at any time. So I am just kind of interested to see how that's going to develop in the next few weeks.
Well, I want to thank the both of you for sharing your insights on the program today. That's NHPR's Jordan Haim and Nancy West of InDepthNH.org. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you.
And you can follow all of their coverage. We've got links to it at our website, NHPR.org. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Organization Day, a day when new lawmakers take their oaths of office, leaders are chosen. And this year, lawmakers contend with pandemic-related guidelines. What do you hope will come out of this legislative session? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to start this part of the program by talking about Organization Day. This is the day that new lawmakers get sworn in. A few rules are set. Leaders are chosen. But this Organization Day was unlike any other because of COVID-19, of course. Joining us now to talk about Organization Day are Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, and Todd Bookman, reporter for NHPR. Thanks to both of you for being on the program.
Happy to be here.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Ethan.
So let's start with you, Todd. Tell us about why Organization Day is important to the legislature.
Sure. So Organization Day kind of serves two purposes. One, it's really the ceremonial start to the new session. You can think of it as a clean slate. Everybody who is elected in November gathers. There's this roll call, and then the 400 new House members and 24 new state senators are all sworn in. The governor delivers the oath of office. So that's sort of the ceremonial side of things. The second function of Organization Day traditionally has more consequences. There are a number of elections held, and these are for a pretty powerful position. So the Speaker of the House, the Senate President, and then also the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, as well as the House Clerk and the Sergeant at Arms. So that's generally the rundown of Organization Day.
And this year was different because of COVID-19, of course. We'll talk a little bit about those elected leadership positions in just a moment. But let's talk about the fact that it was outside. I mean, Ethan DeWitt, to what extent did it being outside make a difference this year?
Yeah, well, the choice to put it outside was after kind of a lot of hand-wringing. And it's important to note that this is a transition day where kind of we were going from a Democratic leadership to Republican leadership. So there were kind of a lot of logistics that had to be kind of passed over from one administration to the next. And the one question was where the venue was going to be. Originally, it was going to be in the Hamel Recreation Center, which is there was, like, I understand, like a basketball court and sort of a basketball stadium where people would be able to kind of sit on the court and also kind of sit up in the risers. And as the cases began to grow last week, there was more and more Democratic opposition to meeting indoors at all. And late Sunday night, the incoming Senate President Chuck Morse, or the assumed Senate President, and the Speaker, Dick Hinch, both issued a joint statement saying that they would move to outdoors. So it was kind of a last-minute change that happened a few days before. And it definitely made the logistics on Wednesday interesting.
Interesting. There's a weighted word. In what way is it interesting?
Well, I was there in person, and it was, I wouldn't know, it was about hovering around 39 to 40 degrees, so not what you would call the coldest winter day, but certainly not a warm day. It was the kind of day where you could kind of sit for half an hour, 45 minutes, 60 minutes, and maybe not notice it. Most people were bundled up. But after about that first hour, it really, the chill was starting to set in. And because everybody is socially distanced, the proceedings are ongoing, there wasn't really a lot of opportunity to get up and walk around. And so there was definitely, as you got a sense as the day went on, that representatives were sort of in a hurry to leave. And some of the challenges and the parliamentary bickering that you normally get, they started to die down as the day wore on, because frankly, people were getting cold.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Ethan, you've reported a bit on a gathering of GOP lawmakers and lawmakers-elect who met at McIntyre Lodge, who may have been exposed to COVID-19. Can you break it down for us about why that was important, especially for Organization Day in particular?
Yeah. So this is a very last-minute thing. And as I mentioned, there had already been hand-wringing discussions over the safety of Organization Day well before we knew about this outbreak. It had already moved outdoors on Sunday. But on Tuesday, 24 hours before Organization Day, It emerged that there had been an outbreak, and I should say Adam Sexton of WMUR broke this story, and it basically confirmed with the Department of Health and Human Services that there had been an in-person caucus meeting of the House Republican caucus. That was to elect their nominee for Speaker, Dick Hinch, who now is the Speaker, and that event had been held indoors. It had been held in a ski lodge at the McIntyre ski area, and that there had been an unspecified number of COVID-19 positive cases that resulted from that. So that emerged, again, from the media. It didn't emerge from any press release from the Republican Party. It didn't emerge from anything official from the House. And it immediately sparked an outrage among Democrats because they said that they were not told of those positive cases by the incoming House leadership 24 hours ahead of this organization day. And that they had to learn about it by reading a tweet from a reporter. And so that kind of created this, uncharacteristically fiery statement from the outgoing Democratic Speaker, Steve Sturtliff, who, castigated the Republicans for what he said was irresponsibility and for a lack of communication, which he said put members at risk. And it set in motion a series of decisions where by the next morning you saw the incoming Democratic House leader, Rennie Cushing, announcing he himself wouldn't even show up to the organization day and that a lot of his colleagues would not as well. And then you ended up with an organization day in which only two-thirds of the House showed up on a day that is, as Todd mentioned, meant to be an important day for swearing people in. So it was a kind of a chaotic 48 hours.
Well, I want to bring Governor Sununu into this for a moment because he was asked yesterday about the broader political conversation that happens in the state and elsewhere about mask wearing and the fact that, GOP members of the House and Senate have been, by and large, less likely to wear masks and obey the social distancing guidelines and whatnot. And so Governor Sununu was asked, how do you, as the top politician in the state of New Hampshire, depoliticize the wearing of masks? And Governor Sununu responded by saying basically every time he sent out a guideline or a quote-unquote restriction, it's done with an abundance of data to back up that decision. So he was leaning heavily on data, and here's what he went on to say.
If individuals are so frankly stubborn that they, and I don't care what party you're from, I don't care, the virus doesn't care. If you're going to be stubborn and not manage and be responsible, then yes, individuals are going to get infected, and we've seen that, unfortunately. So it really is about personal responsibility at the end of the day. This is the live free or die state, which means that while we try to limit the size of government and the overreach of government as much as we possibly can, that also means we also take on, as individuals, that responsibility for ourselves and for our community and our families and the gatherings that we might be involved in. And that's why it's so important to take that responsibility. As we've said it 1,000 times, when we put on a mask and we keep social distancing, we're doing it for others, not for ourselves.
That's Governor Sununu speaking at the press conference yesterday. And on that subject of personal responsibility, and as you mentioned, Ethan DeWitt, a lot of Democratic lawmakers did try to take personal responsibility for their own health and not show up. And so Todd Bookman, lawmakers did accomplish some things. A lot of new ones were sworn in. How many were sworn in at Organization Day this week? Do you know?
So we had 270 people were in person. That's what the roll call showed, out of 400 members of the House. And so those who were present were sworn in. The other 130, the balance of the House, was sworn in virtually the next day by Governor Sununu. There really was some symbolism on the ground. You looked out on this athletic field on the campus of UNH, where white folding chairs had been spaced 6 feet apart, and there were so many empty chairs when you looked out into the audience. But then you also, if you glanced over, there was a really sizable section of lawmakers who declined to wear masks, refused to wear masks. They were sort of seated separately. Nearly all Republican estimates were somewhere between 50 and 75. It was sort of hard to get an accurate count, but you just, it was quite clear sort of, you know, who was following COVID-19 related precautions, at least on a, you know, political partisan basis.
Mm-hmm. Some leaders were elected, as you mentioned earlier in the program. Secretary of State Bill Gardner was reelected to his post for a 23rd term. No surprises there, eh, Todd? I mean, he ran unopposed.
He did run unopposed. And for Gardner, yeah, something of a New Hampshire institution, 23rd consecutive two-year term. He did run unopposed 2 years ago. He did face sort of his first serious challenge in a long time. That was from Colin Van Ostern. But this year, nobody took up running against Gardner. You know, he was praised by those who nominated him for how the New Hampshire presidential primary went off earlier this year. You'll remember it sort of stood in contrast to the debacle in Iowa surrounding their caucus. And then on Election Day, you know, unprecedented challenges this year. You had something like 250,000 New Hampshire residents voting absentee by mail. Then we had, you know, record turnout at the polls itself. And Gardner, you know, received a lot of praise for what was perceived as a relatively smooth carrying out, you know, of the election. The Secretary of State does more than just oversee elections, but Gardner certainly took a lot of praise for how things went in November.
And Todd Buchman, Ethan just mentioned a little while ago that it wasn't entirely surprising that the Senate elected Chuck Morris as its leader and Dick Hinch for the House. There wasn't any particular battle over that, was there?
Not that we are aware of, no. So these issues were sort of settled in caucus prior to Organization Day. You know, both of these men are well known. They're sort of longtime state house figures. Chuck Morris has held the Senate president position before, a longtime lawmaker from Salem. Dick Hinch has held leadership ranks in the Republican caucus in the House, seventh term gentleman out of Merrimack. So no real surprises there for the two leadership positions.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Majority Leader Dick Hinch speaking at Organization Day.
I hope that I have demonstrated that my door will always be open. You know, I will always do my best to listen to you, to hear your concerns, and work with you to find practical solutions.
So Dick Hinch getting, it seems, a little emotional on Organization Day, Ethan.
Yes, and I do wonder if this was kind of the event that he was hoping for. Obviously, that's an emotional moment for anyone to become speaker. But again, there was, you know, a third of the House was not present, and it does, I think, highlight that as kind of as big of a moment for him. There's significant challenges ahead. You know, even on a meeting by meeting basis, it's you know, there is a constitutionally required day, January 6th, for them to meet again. It has to happen in some way, but kind of what the venue is for that is unclear. And that's setting aside, you know, the next few months of committee meetings and everything. So it was kind of, as Todd noticed, as he was speaking, it was an emotional moment. And as you could hear, he was kind of choking back tears. But the visual of it with, you know, so many empty seats while it was happening kind of indicated kind of the challenges we might see in the next few months.
Okay. Well, Ethan, I wanted to ask you about a few things that lawmakers did decide this week. They nailed down a few rules for conducting business in the legislature this session, including a few rules that we talked about 2 years ago about this time when Democrats took control, the allowing of guns in the chamber and mandatory sexual harassment training. So first, Ethan DeWitt, let's start with the guns. What were the details on that vote?
Yeah, so just to be clear, this was an unusual thing to do. Generally, Organization Day, which was Wednesday, that's meant for swearing in officers, swearing in lawmakers and electing officers. It's kind of, that's the purpose of that day. And then the House meets on convening day in January. This time they, you know, generally the rules are kind of held over from the last session for the House. This time there was a motion on the floor, which again was unusual, to amend those motions a month early. And these amendments were kind of inevitable. But one of them was the House, the ban on firearms and deadly weapons in the House chambers and in the House gallery. This has been an issue that's kind of flip-flopped back and forth between Democratic and Republican control. It was a rule up until 2004 that, you know, firearms and weapons were not allowed on the House floor.
But in recent years, it's become a bit of a partisan issue, and there's been arguments that it's unconstitutional to not allow representatives to carry concealed weapons and firearms, you know, while they're voting.
And in part, so, this has been an issue, Ethan, because over the years, we have seen examples of lawmakers bringing guns into the chamber and accidentally dropping them, which has been alarming to people nearby.
Sure. And there's been some, kind of headline-grabbing examples of that. And so in 2018, incoming Speaker Steve Shurtleff passed a rule change that banned it. This was not a new rule change, but, it was sort of along the theme of growing partisan division that we've seen in the House over the last 2 to 4 years. It was, very angrily received on the other side. There was even a lawsuit filed against it that alleged that it was unconstitutional. And it kind of, led to and the inevitability that this rule will be reversed.
And how about the mandatory sexual harassment training?
Sure. This is a new one. This is something that what had happened in between 2016 and 2018, which was when Republicans were in control. There had been this kind of coincided with the Me Too movement, and which kind of started in late 2016 into 2017. There was a large amount of complaints about sexual harassment, against lobbyists, against other lawmakers, and the press was, we were reporting this, it became very public, and it became something that when the Democrats took control, they wanted to do something about. So there had been these annual anti-sexual harassment trainings, like you might get at any workplace. But those have been very poorly attended. Of the 400 members, there had often only been a dozen or two in the room, and many of them had stayed home. So when Democrats took power, they decided they wanted to make those mandatory, again, like you might get at a workplace. And they created a system where you had to attend one of a number of opportunities in person to look at these trainings, which are put on by the Attorney General's office, what constitutes harassment, what goes over the line, what you need to be aware of, et cetera. And the deal was that if you didn't attend those, there might be repercussions. Well, those repercussions came to fruition earlier this year before the pandemic, in the month before House Speaker Shurtleff, again, a Democrat, issued formal reprimands to Republicans. There was a handful of Republicans who refused to show up to the anti-sexual harassment trainings. Those reprimands became kind of a symbol of the partisan distrust from the Republican side of the Democrats. And a lot of Republican leadership, while they had supported the rule, they then turned on the anti-sexual harassment rule and they repealed it on Wednesday.
Okay.
So right now there will be, I assume, anti-sexual harassment trainings going ahead, but there won't be a mandate anymore that lawmakers show up. And it'll be interesting to see if the attendance drops again.
Todd Bookman, going forward, what do you imagine the next session is going to look like? Are all 400 plus lawmakers going to meet outside? Are they going to meet at UNH as they've done in the past? What's it going to look like in your view?
Your guess is as good as mine on this topic, Peter, and I'll let Ethan chime in as well. But at this point, we don't have real clarity on what this may look like. The Democrats did propose allowing virtual participation on Organization Day. That was voted down by the GOP members, but that doesn't mean we may not see a switch moving forward. But, the logistics are complicated. You've got lots and lots of committee hearings on the variety of bills that move through the House through each session, and you need to ensure that there's public access and public participation in those. And then on voting days, you've got, in theory, 400 members of the House trying to gather, trying to debate, and carry off voting. And we may see folks gathering at UNH. It's unclear if we could really do more of these outdoor events as the temperature drops. The State House is likely out of the question at this point, just because the facility itself is just not equipped to socially distance this many lawmakers. But there is still an open question about how this will go down. We may see in person at UNH. We may see some sort of hybrid model. For now, though, nobody's quite sure.
What about you, Ethan? What do you think?
Yeah, it's really hard to see. It's clear that Speaker Hinch is being responsive, but he has expressed consistent preference to meet in person, and his party has as well. There, back in the summer, there was an effort by Democrats to send a question to the Supreme Court, which was successful, but the question was whether it's constitutional for the House to meet remotely and kind of do what we're all used to now, which is, you know, a Zoom Zoom voting, Zoom hearings, take things virtual. And at the time that that question was proposed, there was a lot of Republican opposition to the question itself. And the Supreme Court has recently ruled that, or issued an opinion, I should say, that they don't see any constitutional issues, that the House can meet and vote remotely. And so that's kind of a green light. But and Hinch has kind of seemed to be responsive. Again, he moved the venue outdoors on Wednesday. But it's unclear what we'll see as we get closer. One thing that is clear is that Speaker Hinch wants to keep the same aggressive schedule that every House has every year. And it's notable that when the pandemic started, the House shut down. Back in March, the House shut down for business for months. Right now, we have 727 bills that have been filed. There's likely to be more. And in order to cycle through that many bills in, you know, just a span of 5 or 6 months, you need to have weekly committee meetings. You need to have at least once a week, often twice a week, House voting sessions that sometimes go on for 8 hours. So these are logistical questions that we don't know the answers to yet. If they can find a virtual hybrid model, that would probably be the best solution. But we don't really know where leadership is heading with this, and we don't know what's feasible in the long term. So it's definitely something to keep watching.
Okay. Well, in a short time we have left, Ethan, and then I'll ask you, Todd. Ethan, you're describing this as it's going to be an aggressive schedule if Dick Hinch gets his way. What legislative priorities are you going to be closely watching in the 2021 session?
Sure. Well, the big thing is the budget. And it always is in the first year after an election. This budget will be interesting because we have some revenue losses, but they're not they aren't as deep as we thought. There was initial projections of like a $500 million budget hole caused by a dip in business taxes, but businesses have actually been doing better than thought, and so there might be less to cut, but there still will be probably some cuts coming, and there'll be some heavy fights about that. And the second thing is education funding. There's been a big year-long commission that was set up before the pandemic and was meant to look at how do we kind of fix the inequities between the towns. There's another case moving to the Supreme Court, similar to the Claremont case. And so we're going to see this change in leadership from Democratic to Republican, and we're going to see these issues that have been going on for, frankly, 20, 30 years, debated again in terms of how to best fund New Hampshire schools. So I'll be watching that.
And NHPR's Todd Bookman, what do you think? What legislation will you be looking for this next session?
Well, I think we should keep our eye on taxes and tax rates. The GOP has signaled a preference for possibly cutting the meals and rooms tax. That's a tax that's paid when you stay at a hotel or eat out at a restaurant. And we could see further reductions in business taxes. That's something that the Republican Party has backed in recent terms. So I think watching those two fights play out should be quite telling. But again, you've got Republicans holding majorities in both the House and Senate, and with Governor Sununu in the governor's office.
That's NHPR's Todd Bookman. Todd, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Peter.
We've also been hearing from Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor. Ethan, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find links to the stories that they've covered at our website, nhpr.org. Still to come, we've got Jake Sullivan, faculty member at UNH Carsey School of Public Policy. He was tapped to join President-elect Biden's cabinet as national security advisor, making him one of the youngest in decades. We'll talk to someone who knows his work very well. What do you think of his appointment? And what do you hope the next president will do when it comes to national security policy? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. On Monday, we're talking with Maria Hinojosa. anchor and managing editor of NPR's Latino USA, and author of the new book, Once I Was You. You can send your questions for her to exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, we're checking in on some of the news of the week. Jake Sullivan, faculty member at UNH's Carsey School of Public Policy, was tapped to join President-elect Biden's cabinet as the National Security Advisor, making him one of the youngest in decades. Previously, Sullivan served in the Obama administration as National Security Advisor to then-Vice President Biden and was Director of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State and Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. We are joined now by Michael Ettlinger, Director of the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH, to talk about Sullivan's work on the national stage and at the university. Thank you very much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So what did Jake Sullivan do at UNH?
So he was a senior fellow at the Carsey School. He also, I think he was most known to our students for teaching a class in our Master's in Public Policy program, Policy Across Borders. He's also on an advisory board at the Rudman Center at the law school.
And so he has quite a substantial resume already from his work with the Obama administration, working with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. What skills do you think he brings to the position?
Jake is a very smart guy. He's very studious. He listens to expertise. He's very respectful of expertise. You know, he's calm. I mean, he's kind of like if you were creating a checklist of what you wanted in a national security advisor. He really brings a lot to the job, as well as just, he's young, but he was in for most of the Obama administration and, was in the room, as is said. He's going to be able to hit the ground running.
Is youth an asset in your view for this position?
I'm not sure it's an asset or a detriment. I think what matters is really kind of what he's done and what he brings to the table, and he brings everything we need. So
what kind of role might he play in negotiations of any kind?
Well, I think that varies from administration to administration, and I don't, really know what they're thinking. One thing I'd also just add about Jake is the class he taught actually for us at the Carsey School, its focus was on the interaction of what happens internationally and what happens domestically, that in the world today, you can't, what U.S. domestic policy has big implications in other countries, and what happens in other countries has big implications in the United States. And a lot of what Jake has been talking about, in recent days since he's been selected by President-elect Biden, has been about how, in engaging in foreign policy, it has to be grounded in how it affects Americans in the United States. And I think that's an important thing that he brings to it, that, foreign policy and national security policy has often been treated as a parlor game we play in other countries. But, him bringing that sort of domestic experience as well as foreign policy experience, is obviously affecting how he thinks about the job.
Can you give us an example of the kind of thing that might happen in another country that would, as Jake Sullivan may have studied, affect domestic policies or domestic affairs here in the United States, something that he might be focusing on in the Biden administration?
Well, there's a really easy example right now, infectious disease starts to take hold in another country. Obviously the other country's response has a big effect on the U.S. And there's just throughout trade and labor rights and, tons of things affect the U.S. economy and, as the other example shows, U.S. health. I do think, a lot of what happens in foreign policy is reactive, and it's hard to say, what the situation is going to be when Biden takes office and Jake, steps into his role. So it's hard to anticipate. But I will say that it's very clear one focus is going to be rebuilding the relationship with allies. So whatever comes down the pike, whatever happens, we're not doing it alone. The Trump administration had real disdain and was openly hostile in a lot of ways to to U.S. allies. And you know, I think that's going to be job one, really, for the new administration, is letting them know we're back working together with other countries to deal with problems, and we're back, you know, as a leader in that.
And what about Iran? To what extent is Iran going to be a top of mind issue for the Biden administration? And what role might Jake Sullivan play in advising the president-elect on that?
Well, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Jake was very involved with Iran when he was at the State Department, and I'm sure he'll be very involved again. He's very expert in it. And, you know, what is going to happen there? I mean, honestly, part of it just depends on a lot can happen in however many days it is between now and Inauguration Day. So a lot, you know, so we don't know what the situation will be. And I'm also sure there is, you know, a great deal of intelligence that we are not aware of. And I'm sure it'll be guided by that as well. So it's hard to say where it'll go, because on the outside, we don't know really where we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Ettlinger, director of the Carsey School of Public Policy at UNH, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us about Jake Sullivan. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And before we go, just want to bring in a listener question. This is, of course, a forum for questions from you about things happening in our state. And we get this note from Janet in Laconia, who said, I thought masks were now required in New Hampshire places of businesses. I see restaurants with chefs, cooks, and waitstaff, all with no face coverings. Can someone clarify this for me? I would love to eat out, but can't even get takeout from a restaurant that does not wear masks. That's from Janet in Laconia. So, Janet, per Governor Sununu's order, the mandate applies everywhere, indoors and outdoors, where it is impossible to maintain 6-foot social distancing. The mandate does not include any specific fines or penalties. However, businesses can be fined for not following COVID-19 safety orders. Towns and cities may also pass their own mask ordinances with fines. Hope that helps, Janet. Thank you very much for your question. This is the New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Hope you have a safe and happy weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.